Started. All right, Shashank, how you doing? Sorry everybody. We are a couple days late. Shashank had a really swell time at Coachella and got a little case of the sniffles. So we are back recording on Saturday. I hope you're feeling a little bit better now.
A little bit better. Still a little sick. I think it's been going around. If you're in the Bay Area, a lot of people have been getting sick. Try to hydrate, get plenty of rest, drink your fluids. I think it was like the flu or something. Hopefully, I don't get you sick. But
Fingers crossed. I got my flu shot this year.
oh, amazing.
Yeah. Did you get your flu shot?
I didn't. Isn't it kind of early to get the flu shot?
Well, I got it like December time.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So I don't know. I feel like it lasts, right? It builds.
Couple months. All right.
I mean, like, I got like a bunch of vaccines too. 'Cause like when I was doing like some traveling at the end of last year. So I just got like every single vaccine I could possibly find. I don't know. I got just stuck a bunch of needles in me.
Fantastic.
So I think I'm just immune to everything right
Amazing. I wish I had your genetics. That sounds
now.
and all those injections. But
We'll find out. Like, I might call you tomorrow and be like,
I think I should have taken some before heading out into the desert to go to Coachella, which is why we kind of didn't record last week either and brought something out from our backlog. But it was a really good festival. Especially the production quality keeps getting bigger, louder, more stunning, visually like spectacular. And I noticed some visualizations used AI generated animations and visuals from some of the smaller stages. But the specifically I think like the DJs and I think I saw Kid Cudi too
Nice.
show a bunch of mushrooms with the trippy animations merging into different objects, which kind of made sense and fit the theme of what he was going for. But some of the bigger artists or bigger stages had very robotic and AI messaging in their videos. So even if they weren't AI generated, specifically the one with Grimes and Anima, who's a DJ, they had this really amazing detailed characters. One was a robot and one was some kind of a human hybrid, and they were fighting over the earth, and I think Grime came out in some kind of a werewolf costume or something,
Wow.
shot the robot in the head to free the earth from the
Yeah,
tyranny of machines. And I think it's been on everyone's mind.
it feels very fitting right now.
Even the artists, they're trying to comment on how AI is overshadowing everything else and permeating every aspect of human society.
I feel like the artists are maybe scared.
I think they're scared, they're excited, they're trying to leverage AI and technology to empower them to create more art or more multimodal art, for lack of a better
Yeah.
word, combine visuals and animation, lights, sound.
So you mentioned that some of the artists had like generative AI animations. How do you know that? Like, how do you know that it was like generative AI animations? Or like, I guess I should say, like, what makes you think that it was like generative AI?
You know, you can tell. I saw this last year too, when I think it was Stable Animation or something even before that. We had ways to generate images with like Midjourney and DALL-E a while back, and they just took those images and scaled, rotated, zoomed in, pan left and right, and then like generate another image and slowly like pan, zoom, and continue that same loop and iterate. So you can tell when things kind of merge from one object into another and things look kind of cool, but if you start paying attention to the details, there's like an extra arm floating around,
Like a
or
hand with six fingers or something like
yeah,
that.
or like objects that shouldn't exist, like the mo like some kind of a weird Mobius strip that is actually a house or something like that.
I see. I see. Yeah, I mean, it sounds like Coachella was like a really good time. And what do you think? Do you think any of those artists maybe used AI to help them generate their music?
Ooh, that's a tricky one. I don't know off the top of my head, but I do think these tools are being used by the post-production and the people mixing and working on the finer details, because we use a bunch of these tools ourselves to do some audio leveling, removing the noise. And we were also going to start experimenting with creating an intro and outro music with a theme song with an AI-generated music website. I think it was
Suno.
Suno,
Suno
yeah.
AI. Suno AI is awesome. So for those that don't know, Suno AI is this website where you can go and you can put in like any prompt you want. You can say like, I want a melodic dubstep about San Francisco in the wintertime. And it'll make like a whole song about that. Or like bluegrass music or Japanese shamisen, whatever you want, choir music, it will go and then generate it. And it actually sounds super, super good. Shashank and I were playing with that, like, I think it was like 2 or 3 weeks ago. And I was ridiculously impressed with the quality of the music. Now,
Excuse me.
I would say that in general, the music sounds like, you know, almost as good as you'd get from like a regular artist, but I felt like the it didn't have the same kind of flow that you'd normally have with like an artist. Like I felt like sometimes like the beginning of the song, it's kind of hard to articulate because it wasn't always like this, but I felt like you know like how you have like a song and kind of like maybe like will build and then there might be like a drop or like some sort of thing and then like you'll keep going, and then like it'll sort of end in sort of like a nice finishing way, like where you kind of know the song's over. I felt like sometimes with this, each individual section of the song sounded like amazing, as if like a regular artist would do it. But the entire song, to me, didn't have that same kind of coherent storyline that you would have in like a regular song. Now, I think this is like a super subjective thing because like, you know, what is like good music is, you know, highly, highly subjective. But like to me it felt like, you know, oftentimes like the song would go, but then like it would end and it would end just like a little bit soon, I would say, right? Like it was just like, oh, like I felt like this should be like, I don't know, like a downbeat or an upbeat or something like that. It just kind of like cut off a little early. But like I don't know. I was like super impressed by what it's been able to give off.
Excuse me. Yeah, I think that kind of makes sense because we even had a couple researchers and startups present at our early meetup events last year, when they were working on generating sound with a bunch of content that they had.
Well, that was with Dr. Maya Ackerman.
That's right. She was one, and then there was another startup. I forget the name, but they had a huge library of sounds, samples, and hold recordings with like full songs and individual tracks with individual instruments. And they built up this huge library. Because they were just supporting artists and helping them create more music by picking samples from other instruments. And they were like, okay, let's build an AI on top of this. And they were focused on just generating, I think
I
like
think it was
a
mostly
couple
lyrics,
seconds at a
right?
time.
I thought it was mostly lyrics, right?
No, it was sound too.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. But yeah, they had lyrics. They had sound samples. And I think that's kind of what we're getting right now, where we're getting cool sounding music and lyrics that they're able to combine. But I'm guessing it'll take maybe another generation or another few iterations for them to take what they have right now and then build some kind of a prompt engineering chain of thought style layer on top of that to arrange all these different interconnected pieces and build a coherent 3 to 4 minute song out of that, which hits like all the beats and makes it sound awesome to a human being.
Yeah, for sure. Now, I'm trying to see if I can maybe sign in and then we could play it, because I think it should be fine to play it. Oh, here we go. Here's one that is generated like all AI and Suno, since this is an audio podcast.
That's great.
Yeah, it sounds pretty good.
And so we generated like what, a dozen samples like these, and then picked one that we liked.
Yeah, I think each one was maybe like 2 cents or something like that to generate. I think it was like each. Well, I don't know. I can't remember the exact pricing, but it was very reasonable, far cheaper than hiring an artist.
I mean, this is really exciting. We're jumping into different modalities. I think this is how we'll eventually get to AGI, not by one big step function where we discover something new, but just by piecing together all these different modalities and giving the LLMs today the ability to think in different verticals.
So that sounds a lot like Mark Zuckerberg, what he said.
A lot of people have been saying that, yeah.
Yeah.
Because like even OpenAI with Sam Altman talking about Sora, he's like, we're adding all these different capabilities and combining them into one big model. DALL-E was a separate model initially, and then with GPT-4, they kind of just rolled that up into one big thing.
So do you think that AGI is going to be a mixture of experts model?
I think it's going to be, you know, I mean, that's how the human brain works, isn't it? We have a bunch of different regions in our brain, which are all specialized to focus on specific things.
Yeah, that's true.
So it's only natural to assume that if we're modeling these artificial intelligent things on human neural networks, then they would have similar behavior where you have specialized tools or specialized models focused on a specific domain, and then something higher up orchestrating all those different models and forming true intelligence.
So for those that don't know, I think we've explained it in previous podcasts, but mixture of experts is a type of model that you can kind of think of like as like a team or like a company where it is one singular model that you will use. But within the model, there's going to be different kind of like sub domains within the model. So like I like to think about kind of like if you have a company, you're going to have your marketer, you're going to have your sales or salesperson, maybe your computer programmer, you're going to have maybe your QA, whatever, HR. And each person is good at a particular vertical or domain. And then the CEO of the company will kind of talk with all of them and make them all work together in unison, right? And that's kind of how I think of these mixture of experts models, where you have a single orchestrator which will talk with each of the individual pieces parts of the model, and in a certain sense, you're just talking to the CEO. So it's like, it's like you're talking with a company almost, and there's lots of sub processes, or like I don't know the best way to describe this. There's lots of like expertise within the model itself, as opposed to just like one really smart guy. So that's a mixture of experts. So, anyways, back to where we were.
Speaking of that, there's a new mixture of experts MoE model out from Snowflake, and this one's like a massive mixture.
It's huge.
So for context, Mixtral had the most popular mixture of experts model, I guess apart from GPT-4, which is also rumored to be a mixture of experts.
But we have no idea because it's proprietary.
Yeah, so the ones that are public and share how the architecture works was Mixtral, which is an 8x7b model, which has 8 smaller models, each of which is about 7 billion parameters. And now we have a new one from Snowflake, which is...
Wait, so taking a step back, you said 8 by 7B. So that means there's 8 models that are running, and then each of them are 7 billion parameters.
That's right.
So that would that mean that I would say, like, okay, 7 times 8? So what is that, 56?
Yeah,
56 billion parameters total.
So it's roughly as powerful as a 56 billion parameter model, but runs as quickly and as efficiently as a 7 billion parameter model. And that is roughly as much as you can run on a new laptop these days.
Okay, yeah, because I just...
entry-level laptop.
...was running an 8 billion parameter model on my MacBook Air, like a base model MacBook Air, and it runs fine. It runs like probably about as fast as ChatGPT. So,
and this was the new Llama 3 model.
This is the new Llama 3 model. We can talk about
we'll get there later.
Yeah, we'll get there. So teaser for later on in the show, but yeah, we will talk about that. So anyways, back to Snowflake.
Yeah, massive model, or massive number of experts in this one model. I'm not entirely sure. Have you seen any benchmarks about how this compares to existing models?
You know, I was looking. They claim that it's the biggest open source model, which is cool. As for benchmarks, I don't know. I played with it a little bit, so there is the ability to go and play with it on Hugging Face. I have it hosted there, and it was impressive, I would say. I think that to me, it feels like GPT-4 like quality.
Wow.
Yeah.
GPT-3, you mean?
No.
The Snowflake model feels like GPT-4 quality.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. Probably not quite there, but it feels very good.
Huh.
Yeah.
So I'm looking at some benchmarks in this Snowflake blog. And it's comparable to the new DBRX model, which is supposed to be the best open source model before the new Llama 3 model came out. So very impressive and very small, very efficient. But like without getting too deep into the numbers, it seems like every company is trying to jump on this bandwagon, get their feet wet by building their own custom model, training with their own proprietary data and maybe some publicly available data. And we have a lot of options. It's honestly a little overwhelming. The previous king of the hill was DBRX from Databricks, which was, I think, also a mixture of experts model. Now we have Snowflake. I'm sure Mistral is still going strong and working on the next generation of both proprietary and open source models. But I do think that Meta has a bigger wallet than any of these little companies.
Yeah.
And
well, Snowflake isn't that little of a company. So anyways, just for all the listeners to keep up, we're throwing out a lot of acronyms, a lot of companies.
Yeah.
Right now, we're talking about like three companies at the moment. We're talking about Snowflake, which is a company which does, what does Snowflake do? They like host hardware, right? Like computers and stuff?
Yeah, mostly like data warehousing, I believe. They're a data cloud.
Yeah, so would they compete with like all the big boys like Google Cloud and like AWS and stuff like that? Or are they a little bit different?
They're not as full service as AWS and Cloud, Google Cloud and Azure, obviously, but I think they focus on data hosting.
Okay. So yeah, so Snowflake, they have their own model. DBRX, which is another model, which Shashank mentioned, from Databricks, which also happened to be kind of like the king of the hill. It is very similar to the Llama models from Facebook, but potentially maybe even a little bit better. A lot of people said that like the DBRX model from the company Databricks was, one of the best ones. And then Another one Shashank mentioned is the Llama 3, which is another model. So all these models kind of do the same thing, but just made by different companies, all open source. And that's the new Llama 3 model from Facebook. All right.
Yeah. So taking a little bit of a step back, it seems like this field is kind of like maturing, and I'm starting to see parallels with the mobile industry, where you have a bunch of manufacturers, a bunch of software developers that build OSs on top of that, and everyone is working on these tiny little changes and pushing the industry forward. And whatever we say, whatever big best model that we talk about today, it's not going to be the same a week or a month, or definitely not like a year from now.
Constantly updating,
constantly like pushing each other to do better, be more efficient, cost effective, and try to squeeze as much as they can out of the hardware that we have, because these things are expensive. The amount of money they're burning and the amount of NVIDIA chips that they're using, and maybe like their own chips too, it's just insane.
Super expensive. So I want to go back to like your analogy on like mobile, right? Because
yeah.
I think that like mobile is interesting because, and I agree with you in a certain sense, but right now with like mobile, there's really only two phone operating systems. There's iOS and there's Android.
This is a very Western-centric approach, but sure. I mean, there's a lot of Chinese manufacturers who don't have the option to use Android, and they're kind of forking off to do something.
Android.
And I mean, that wasn't always the case. We are, 15, 20 years into this mobile industry. But if you look back at the early days, we had tons of companies. We had Pebble, Palm. We had Windows try to take a stab at mobile. It was very vibrant, the ecosystem.
Yeah, I agree with you that there was a lot, but this feels like a lot more. Like,
yeah,
I don't think that there was ever this many companies trying to make a phone operating system. Yeah. Like, maybe you had, Pebble, you said Palm, I don't know, Nokia,
yeah.
Google with Android, or I think Google bought Android, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah.
iOS, Windows Phone, right? But it was probably like, less than 10, maybe, like for sure under 100. Like definitely under 100. But with this, there are over 600,000 models hosted on Hugging Face alone.
Yeah, 600,000. That is a massive number.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying, right? It's like, it's like way different. Like in a certain sense, I wouldn't necessarily compare this to the mobile phone companies, but like I would maybe compare this more to like the internet, like websites. Because if you think about apps on top of operating systems, or like, websites, where they're just like so many, and then like each model is tweaked for different things. I mean, like a lot of them are like general purpose, but some are fine tuned for specific use cases, right?
Yeah, I suppose it's way more open than the mobile phone ecosystem. There's no like single or monopoly or duopoly that's controlling all of these other developers, or at least not anymore. I think there was a monopoly or duopoly when it was only OpenAI, and then once we had all these open source models, it just blew this field wide open to anyone and everyone.
Yeah, exactly. So I don't know. Like I agree that there are maybe parallels, but to me this feels so much bigger and just different, right? Because also like in order to make a phone, it's very capital intensive because you need to actually build out the hardware. With this, I mean, it's also capital intensive.
Very, very. If anything, I would say more capital intensive.
Yeah. I guess it depends on like what you're doing.
Yeah. Which layer of the stack you're working on.
Well, but the thing is like if you're making a small domain specific model, it's not that capital intensive.
It's not that capital intensive. But also the moat is much smaller. Your entire product company might get swallowed up by the next update to ChatGPT or Llama or Gemini or whatever.
Well, to be fair, none of these companies really have a moat at all. Just because they are, there's all so many open source models that are like state of the art. Like this new Llama 3 model is open source. And I mean, like,
yeah, let's talk about that.
Okay. All right. We come on teasing it. So let's talk about it. So, all right. Llama 3, super excited. You guys may have been familiar with Llama 2. This is Llama 3. So
clearly, 3 is better than 2.
Exactly. It's a new model that Facebook or Meta came out with, I think it was maybe a week or two ago. Mm-hmm. And it comes in different sizes. They have an 8 billion parameter model, and apparently they're working on training a 400 billion parameter model.
But before that, you missed the 70 one.
Oh, a 70 billion parameter model.
8, 70, and they're still trading the biggest 400-something billion parameter model.
So 400 is huge. Like, just wildly huge. We don't know how big GPT-4 is, but this would be, I think, significantly bigger, right?
Yeah, I think GPT-4 was supposed to be a mixture of 8 220 billion parameter models. So, like, OpenAI didn't even train a single model bigger than 220 billion parameters. Or maybe ChatGPT-3 might be a pretty big one. But yeah, this is massive for a single model.
So this could be, like, maybe an order of magnitude better than GPT-4.
I wouldn't say that, because it's a single model as opposed to a mixture of experts.
That's true. But that doesn't mean they couldn't do this as a mixture of experts. Well, I mean, we don't know exactly how they're going to make it.
Yeah, as far as I know, they haven't mentioned anything about it being a mixture of experts model, which is kind of strange if you think about it. It seems like everyone's moving in that direction.
Yeah. But so one thing that is super exciting, and I think, like, the 400 billion parameter model is ridiculously exciting. But honestly, one thing that I'm even slightly more excited about is their 8 billion parameter model. Mm-hmm. And I'll tell you why. So I was able to get the 8 billion parameter model running locally on my MacBook Air, as I mentioned before. And it is really good. It feels about the same as GPT 3.5. So GPT 3.5 is the one that took the world by storm. It's the one that was the fastest growing app, I think, of all time. It had, like, I don't remember exactly, but it was like 100 million users in like the first couple of months. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's really good. That's the ChatGPT, the free version that we all know and love. It's super good. Mm-hmm. And we now have that quality running on my MacBook Air.
Insane.
Like, my base model, lowest end, 8 gigs of RAM, or maybe 16 gigs of RAM. Anyways, like, lowest model MacBook Air. M2, so not even, like, this year's model, like, last year's model. And it works it feels just as good as GPT 3.5. But it's open source, mm-hmm. and it's mine. I can run it when I'm disconnected from the internet. Mm-hmm. It's small. It's only a couple of gigabytes. And
virtually zero latency or no network requests.
Well, yeah, I mean, you have to wait a little bit for, like, it to generate the tokens. But yeah, I mean, I can just run it on my own data. I can fine tune if I want to. I think, like, it's super fun to talk about, like, these new latest and greatest models. But I think, like, for me, like, almost like these 8 billion parameter models, or like the small ones, are, like, more exciting than the big ones.
I think it's more exciting as a developer. The number of applications you can build on top of this locally, I think that's just opens up a whole new world.
And because it's free, right? It's not free, right? You have to buy the computer or whatever. But, like, I already have my computer, and now I could do things that, like, I wouldn't do where I'm paying for a subscription to, you know, one of these big models. Like, mm-hmm. you know, if I'm going to have to spend, you know, a couple cents for, like, every request, I don't want to do it, right? Because that, like, you know, it costs some money. So, like, I have, like, you know, some ideas of things that, like, I would maybe like to do, mm-hmm. But it's just expensive. And, you know, money is not infinite, right? But like, if I could run this locally, one, I have the privacy benefit of not needing to like hit their servers, so like they don't get to train on all my data. And some data, like, I don't actually even want to throw that. I'm like, if I have like some financial or medical data, I want to put that on there. But just like, you know, if there's a lot of stuff, you just do it for free. And that's really exciting to me. And so I like the way I kind of look at it is like the difference between a supercomputer and like a laptop computer, right? Like a supercomputer is really exciting because there's a lot of cool things that you can do with it. Like I could simulate the Big Bang. I could, simulate the weather.
Fold some proteins.
Yeah, fold some proteins. Big financial modeling. Really exciting. Like it's important that we have that because there's a lot of like really interesting problems. But for your average person day to day, like you don't need to simulate the Big Bang. Like you
not can, that relevant to the average Joe.
But like you want maybe some help like drafting an email to your boss or
maybe do your taxes.
Help you with your taxes.
And your calendar.
Maybe summarize like the terms and conditions that you didn't that you said that you read, right? Like this is the kind of thing that like I think a lot of people could use and it could benefit their life. So like while the big LLMs are really exciting, like having an LLM running locally on your device is in my mind almost just as exciting, if not more exciting, just because of the level of access it'll give to people.
I think as a tinkerer, this gets me excited because I can have this run a bunch of agents locally, and all I'm paying for is the electricity, which is pretty negligible on these power efficient M series Apple Macs. And you just have these running for free, explore a bunch of different ideas. Let them run in the background for a couple hours, come back later, and then voila, you have some mind-blowing insight that these mixture of experts have worked together for several human equivalent days, and it's all free.
Yeah. We really live in amazing times. Do you have any ideas for anything that you want to build with these? Like, now that we have this, like, you were mentioning, like, I think you had some ideas of like things you want to build with an agent.
I'm mostly trying to reduce the amount of manual grunt work that I'm doing for all the daily tasks that I have. So specifically for this podcast, there's a bunch of things that we do to upload and research and format and publish. So I'm trying to automate that process so it's a lot faster. That'd be a fantastic benefit.
Yeah. If we could have an agent that would help maybe just replace us for the show.
Well,
maybe not yet. I hope you guys enjoy listening to us banter as opposed to the AI. But if you prefer, maybe we could have like an AI for an episode or something.
We could try to add an AI host.
Maybe. Yeah. We explore. Maybe.
They'll keep getting better.
Yeah,
at some point I can imagine there being an AI that is more witty, more amusing, and more enjoyable to listen to than the two of us.
Yeah, but like you want to hear us, right? Like, we built this bot.
Obviously, we're special. We're never going to be replaced.
That's right. All those other guys, though, like they'll probably, but like yeah, us.
Yeah, I mean, and Lex Friedman guy, he's gone with the next update to Llama.
That's right. Actually, you know, one thing that I was thinking about is when we say that these models will get better, like a lot of these models actually don't like improve. Like once they're trained, they're kind of like as smart as they're going to be. They're not like actually like iterating, like continuing to improve as much, right? It's kind of just like, okay, here's your Llama 3 70B. Mm-hmm. Like you use it, it's kind of fixed. And then like, if you want to improve it, sure you could give like new information. Like you could use, like, you know, throw it in a textbook or like ask questions about a particular thing, but it's not like it's actually like being retrained. Like once it's trained, it's trained, right?
Well, to be fair, I wouldn't say that as an absolute truth. I think that's just the way that it's being done right now. Because once they train this current generation of the model, They already have researchers working on the next gen behind the scenes. So they don't want to keep pouring money into the GPUs and electricity to keep training the current generation while there's a new gen being developed in the pipeline. So as a counterexample, I think you can look at the GPT-4 models and you see multiple snapshots that they keep, it's continuously being trained and we keep getting the newer and newer snapshots over time. But yeah, most models, especially the open source ones that companies like Meta train and then release out in the public, it's just one single snapshot.
Yeah, so I guess that's true that like the individual companies can keep training it. But I guess kind of my point is, I wonder, just thinking out loud, is like, you know, me as a human, I like to think that I'm maybe getting better over time and I'm improving based off of like the inputs that I've seen, right? Like, you know, I've learned from some of my mistakes over the years. Some people would say I'm getting better. Others might say I'm getting worse. But, you know, definitely changing over time, right? But these models, in a certain sense, unless, like, the big companies are willing to, like, continue training it, sure, they could release another thing. Mm-hmm. But then it's, like, a new thing. And it's not, like, constantly being updated like the human brain. So, like, I'm wondering if that is kind of like a requirement that in the future we'll need to have it where we can actually train these models more like in real time, even after it's released. Like, I don't know. Do you think like that feedback loop is important, or maybe it's not actually that important for intelligence?
Excuse me. I'm not sure I see the distinction that you're trying to point out. So maybe this comes back to my analogy with the mobile industry. So you have a bunch of these companies building foundation models and other smaller entities, startups, individuals, taking that and fine-tuning it. So are you saying that it would you're looking for a future where you're able to take a foundation model, fine-tune it, and then have the underlying base model keep getting updated with the same fine-tune layer?
Like, continually improving. Like, as it gets more data, like, it will go and then update, like, in real time with, like, new data. And just continually, constantly update based off of every question that,
I mean, we do have that today, but you just have to specify which snapshot you want to talk to of ChatGPT.
Right, but I'm not saying, like, you know, update the snapshot. Mm-hmm. I'm saying, like, you know, there is not necessarily, like, a snapshot, but just, like, it just continually improves.
Yeah, so I think the problem with that is reproducibility, QA, behavior. If you've, like, spent all this time and energy to get one version of this model working with your workflow, remove the hallucinations, figure out the inconsistencies, you don't want to switch it up constantly.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's true probably in some use cases, but like, what if I just wanted to get smarter? Like, how am I going to get like artificial super intelligence if I can't have like the model like recursively improve?
I think you can only guarantee that if you jump from with each major version update. So from Llama 2 to Llama 3 and GPT 3 to 4 and so on. But if you're jumping from like GPT 4 to 4 Turbo to 4 Turbo snapshot 103 something something, the answer isn't always clear. Sometimes it's better. Sometimes it's just different.
Yeah.
I don't know if you want that.
Yeah, I mean, that's true. I guess just like, you know, thinking out loud here, like in my mind, like if we're going to have an abundant future, and I mean, we'll probably have an abundant future anyways, but like if we're going to have rapidly, exponentially increasing intelligence, I think that like eventually you need the models to train the models. So like I've been thinking like, okay, like what you really want is you want like a model almost training itself and giving itself like more data based on the world, based off of some sort of input. Like, I don't know. Maybe in some sense it'll be interacting with the world, it'll be interacting with different things. Based off of that, it'll go and improve based off of things. And I think that ideally should be able to happen in real time. And it would just like continually getting faster and faster based off of itself. And I think like right now, it's not really done that way.
Well, it depends on which aspect of this process you're talking about. I think we are doing that to some extent at various layers of the stack. So if you rewind like 10, 15 years or something, people were building these models by hand. They were like hard coding the weights. Obviously, the networks were much smaller, so they were able to manually define, okay, this needs to be this weight, and you know, this gate needs to be like this. Eventually, we switched to you know, gradient descent, backpropagation, where we have these large neural networks kind of like decide their own weights to fit the data. And then we had like hyperparameter tuning, which is automatically setting all these things. And now we also have these models generating the training data to train these new models. So it, in some ways, we are slowly automating all these different tasks that humans used to do and replacing that with AI. So one of the big costs of training a new model is to actually use the current model to generate training data. So depending on how you look at it.
And if it's close to free, then it'll be even easier to train these models.
So let's say everything is free. You still have to pay for the electricity somehow.
That's true.
You have the computer that your, you know, older brother gave you or something. You have the model, which is open source, running it locally, you're still paying for electricity. And for some of these bigger models, that's
just like solar panels in your backyard.
Millions of dollars. Well, you still have to pay for the solar panels.
True. I mean, I
find some old free solar panels somewhere.
Yeah, just like go dumpster diving for old solar panels.
Not a bad plan, dude.
Yeah, it's interesting because I remember you were talking that energy is going to be the bottleneck. Like there was that.
That's what Zuck mentioned too, I think.
Yeah, he mentioned that he wasn't aware that there is any one, what is it, gigawatt power station for training these models.
Mm-hmm.
Like he's not aware of anything like that big. There is no 1 gigawatt data center. So
a gigawatt is pretty big.
Really big.
For context, the average household is a couple kilowatts. I think single digit kilowatts.
So what is it? I'm trying to remember. It's like a watt is like what? There's 1 watt, and then a kilo is 1,000.
1,000 right. Watts, which is what maybe like 2,000-3,000 watts is maybe what a single house would use.
It's like a small house.
Small house.
Like,
with like a two people.
Two or three kilowatts. And, so 2,000 or 3,000 watts.
And maybe like an electric car would charge at the average plug-in hybrid, 16 kilowatts or something.
Oh, so a plug-in hybrid is often bigger than a lot of houses.
It charges with more current than a house uses per minute. But you know, you just charge for half an hour to an hour and then you stop.
Well, I guess that makes sense because like your car needs a lot of power, and then like that's gonna charge take you, like
exactly.
A couple hundred miles, and then like that added all up would be less in your like refrigerator and lights.
Exactly. Okay. So a faster charger, which is the Tesla superchargers, they go up to like 250 kilowatts. And that is like, I think it took a lot of engineering for them to get to that number. They started at 75 kilowatts, which is a big number.
Oh, wow. Because like a big house would be like 10 kilowatts. So 250, yeah. That's like
a lot.
Like a small neighborhood.
Yeah. At that point, you're generating a lot of heat. You have to first get the electricity there in those large quantities somehow from wherever it's being generated, the power grid. you have to cool it, and then make sure that you could actually put it into the device that you're trying to charge, which is its whole engineering challenge.
Yeah.
So to do that, we have a network of energy producing infrastructures, everything from I don't think coal is that popular today.
This leaves quite a bit of it, though.
Some. Not as much as it used to be. A lot of natural gas, some renewable energy sources. Out here in California, if you drive down the coast, up and down, you see a bunch of windmills. There's like farms of windmills that litter the California landscape. And there's a bunch of other renewable sources. But large power plants, I think, generate several megawatts. We were just looking this up, and nuclear power plants generate hundreds of megawatts.
It was a gigawatt.
Close, yeah. It ranges from a couple hundred megawatts to close to a gigawatt.
Wait, so just make sure I get this straight, and for all the listeners, it's 1 watt. Like, yeah. So a light bulb would maybe be like
a couple watts,
right? A house is like a
couple kilowatts,
a couple thousand watts.
Yeah.
Power plant would be like a couple million watts.
Yeah.
So like a power plant,
and the largest power plants, a billion.
Like a billion.
Yeah.
So real big.
Yeah.
Really, really big. So what Mark Zuckerberg was talking about in a previous interview that we listened to, we could link to that interview in the show notes.
Yeah.
Pretty interesting interview. But he was saying that he's thinking about making a 1 gigawatt data center that is exclusively used to train these large language models. So that's really, really big.
Mm-hmm.
That's like, I mean, you might as well just build it next to like a nuclear power plant at that point.
Mm-hmm.
So very exciting. But yeah, I do think that is for sure a bottleneck in creating these things. And it makes me wonder if like compute would be the bottleneck, or if like energy would be the model, or maybe both, really. Like, it's going to be two separate bottlenecks, right? Like, you know, it's going to be like the number of GPUs you can buy, or the amount of power that you can get to power the GPUs.
Depends on which costs more. It's a trade-off, right? If you're getting CPUs for cheap, then power becomes a bottleneck. If you're getting power for cheap, then you can use like, I don't know, like chips from the 60s and they'll still be fine, you know? They'll do their little bit.
Yeah,
because power is so cheap.
That's true. But then, like, at that point, space might be your bottleneck, because from the 60s, this is huge.
Mm. Yeah. This is like the going back to Ray Kurzweil's singularity. At some point, you're just running out of silicon atoms, so you just have to terraform other planets to extract all the silicon that you can, because you need all the silicon that you can.
I'm ready. Let's go. Let's go. Take all the silicone from like the asteroids and go build like
silicon, not silicone.
Wait, what did I say?
Silicone.
Silicone versus silicon.
Yeah.
Wait, what's the difference?
One is used in plastic surgery. One is used in computing.
Oh, silicone, yeah. Versus silicon.
Yeah, that's
right. Oh, so silicone is the plastic surgery.
That's right.
And then silicon,
yeah,
is where we are, Silicon Valley.
That's right.
So it's just like an extra E? Is it the same spelling?
No, it's a different spelling.
Oh, okay.
Silicone.
Oh.
I think the Silicon Valley might be somewhere in LA. Or Miami, who knows?
Okay. All right, fair.
But yeah, power at these large scales that these companies are operating, Meta, OpenAI, NVIDIA, Google, power is a bottleneck for them. It's insane.
Huh. So let's imagine for a moment that you were the head of one of these companies.
Mm-hmm.
And you were like tasked with building, you know, GPT-7.
Mm-hmm.
Like, what do you think you would do in order to like set yourself up to be able to make like kind of future-proof it? Right, so that like you would have maybe like the computing and like power requirements to be able to do that.
Well, one thing I might do is open source everything.
why would you do that?
You know, it was hard to understand at first, to be honest. When Meta started open sourcing the first llama, who were like, you know, they're just trying to get into the game. We didn't really understand why. It seems like that's all they could do because they couldn't compete with OpenAI and Google with the technical sophistication of building really good models. So they were like, all right, fine, we'll just build small models, open source it. But now we are two versions ahead, and Llama 3 is really, really good. And the number of things that people have built on top of Llama has been just mind-blowing. Most of the smaller companies are using the Llama models to make improvements, fine-tune it, work on the architecture, apply it to new use cases. So all of these other people building things on top of Llama are teaching Facebook what they can do with their Llama models. So I'm assuming everything that's going to happen today with Llama 3, Facebook can take those learnings and apply that to Llama 4. So I think it kind of like sets you up to build an industry standard with your product and have everyone contribute to make that platform better and get you like free information to build a better product with the next generation. And this is like a very high-level, forward-thinking benefit. But he mentioned how they open-sourced not specifically their core products like Instagram, Facebook, et cetera, WhatsApp, but the underlying technology that powers these things like the servers, PyTorch, React, a lot of the networking switches. And after doing that, a lot of the people in industry have incorporated those tools, improved it, and then Facebook reabsorbed those improvements and helped them make their core technologies better, bring the cost down for manufacturing, and you know, it's like free work for them.
That's true. That is a really good point. Like, we open source the models,
you open source some of the core technology without exposing your product.
Yeah, because I mean, like, people will, I guess, well, with Facebook, you don't necessarily pay for the product. In a certain sense, you are the product, but that's a separate conversation.
Oh, but like, if they open sourced all of Facebook code, then maybe, like, you know, Google could have copied it and made Google Plus a success.
For yeah, example. But honestly, like, with Facebook, I think that their code is not their secret sauce, right? Like, and like, even if Facebook was 100% open source, everything was open source, I think that like they would still be a really, really big and successful company. Because sure, anybody could copy it, but the thing is like Facebook has like 3 billion users or something. It's like huge. Like basically everybody who has like internet access has like some sort of account that is on Meta, right? Like they've got WhatsApp, they've got Facebook, they have Instagram, they have all these things. And I think that like the reason you go to Facebook is because like everybody else is on Facebook. If everybody, like if I took the source code and I copied it somewhere else, mm-hmm. you wouldn't move because like none of your friends are there.
Sure. Network effects.
So I think that that makes it significantly easier for Facebook to open source things that like maybe other companies couldn't, because like their core product in a certain sense is their users and the network effect and not actually like their engineering prowess. I mean, like it is like kind of, but it, even if I could like, you know, just copy it all over, like they have data centers all over the world to be able to host that. Like mm-hmm. Even if I had the source code, it wouldn't be financially possible for me to just like go and like run it off for and host it for 3 billion users.
Yeah. So I guess going back to your original question, what would it take to build GPT-7? So, open sourcing is one way to go. I think it's a very creative approach that's working for Meta. Another thing is, you know, you need GPUs. You need really, really performant, power-efficient chips that are specialized for exactly the kind of thing that you're doing. And depending on who you are, that could either be training or inference. So,
do you think that touching on those chips, do you think that will be like actually GPUs, like general purpose ones, or do you think it might be ones that are like specifically made for training LLMs, like what Cerebrus is doing?
They're no longer general purpose anymore. I don't think these H100s or the B GB200s, etc., are good for gaming anymore. I think they're specifically focused on training AI models and a little bit of inference too.
Okay.
So that's a trade-off too. You build these chips for training, and then they don't perform as well in inference, and vice versa. So I think depending on who you are, these large model providers, they spend a lot of money on inference. I don't even know how many people are hitting OpenAI's endpoints to call their models.
Reminder, inference is just using the model.
Yeah, just generating
some
prompt, generating some response to a prompt.
Yeah.
Depending on that, get the right kind of chips and keep thinking ahead, because this industry is always evolving. I just read, this was 2 days ago, TSMC announced a 1.6 nanometer chip.
It's very small.
I was like, God damn. I remember a couple years ago reading that the limit, according to laws of physics, was somewhere around 4 nanometers, at which point you reach like some kind of a quantum tunneling issue where these semiconductors no longer can guarantee that a charge will stay in one place. It'll just kind of like jump from one place to another because that's how electrons want to move. There's so little energy required to move from one place to another. So it's like, sheesh, it seems like they've come up with some fancy engineering to get around that issue. We're getting smaller and smaller. So this one requires even less energy. It can cram even more transistors in that place.
I wonder if you want to make GPT-7, one of these companies might just want to buy TSMC. Since TSMC is pretty much one of the only company, I think it maybe is the only company in the world right now that can make these chips. Like, everybody uses them. Like, NVIDIA uses them.
They make 90% of the world's chips.
Yeah. Like, I wonder, because, like, I mean, I think we were looking at it before, the market cap of TSMC is big, but it's a lot smaller than some of these, like, big, giant companies.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I wonder if they would consider just, like, buying or, like, trying to...
It's not that small. It's, like, $600 billion. Wait, hold that. USD, yeah.
Oh, $600 billion?
Yeah. Not that small.
maybe you could buy, like, their U.S. branch or something. Maybe. I don't know. Okay. I thought it was smaller. I thought it was, like, $20 billion or something. But, okay, $600 billion is quite large.
Yeah, so what do you need? You need... you need this technology to be standardized, reliable. You need the next generation cutting edge chips. You need like someone, researchers working on better architectures for the underlying model.
Lots of researchers.
And you need like lots of engineers to actually do the training. You need data. You need energy and so many things. So, and speaking of, underlying architecture, it seems like we've kind of settled on this transformer approach, but there's a couple of other approaches being experimented with. But before we get to that, maybe there's also a lot of research being done in extending the context window, where Google released a new paper called Infinity Attention, which comes up with some fancy ways to keep going through like an infinitely long context window and keep that in memory and solve like this needle in haystack problem where you sprinkle some information in some corner of this data set and or the prompt and ask it a question, and it will get this little tiny needle that you place regardless of how big the prompt is.
Okay, so lots of things there.
So
you're mentioning that you think that in order to make the GPT-7, we need a ton of data scientists or machine learning engineers, lots of other regular engineers to go
help. ML scientists.
ML scientists.
Scientists. Researchers.
So let's say we need like, because I mean, you don't need that many, but like a decent amount. Let's say like
best. You need the best.
Let's say like 20 of the best. You just throw money at them. Like
each of them, that's gonna be a lot of money.
like, you know, how much are you? $1 million a year?
Oh, the best. The best are very expensive.
Who would you consider like the best right now? Like who are some of the best?
Ilya Sutskever, Andre Garfathy. You know, there's a bunch of people at Google, the people who worked on the Transformers paper. Now they've kind of branched off into their own companies.
So maybe you don't pay them like in like money, but like you pay them in stock that would potentially be worth a lot of money.
Sure.
You could make them an owner of the company, like give them like 2% or something. Mm-hmm. So maybe like you get the best people and you get like 20 of them, and then each of them gets like 1% or something like that. And so then like you've got 20% of the company, and so they have a huge upside plus like, you know, $1 million a year or something like that. That would be, you know, only $20 million plus like a lot of potential value in the company.
That's just one part of the equation. We haven't even gotten to buying the chips, securing funding for the power or the engineers to build these models and deploy them at scale.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. So then maybe like what you really need to do is you need to like buy a big hunk of land somewhere like where there's really cheap power. Maybe like
that's important
next to like a nuclear power plant, mm-hmm. or like you could make your own nuclear power plant, or like maybe next to like some sort of like hydroelectric dam, or like a natural gas plant, or some sort of like orphaned form of energy. Like basically I would find where they're doing all the Bitcoin mining, mm-hmm. and I would build my plant there. Mm-hmm. You know, maybe like the Bitcoin miners, they've figured something out. Cause like, I mean, like for Bitcoin mining, you want to find like the cheapest form of energy you possibly can. Cause like, it doesn't really matter. You still get like the same Bitcoin at the end of the day. That's where I'd want to train my LLM. Cause at the end of the day, it doesn't actually matter where I am anywhere in the world. Like the model will still be the same, and I can just like transmit it over the internet. So I want a big hunk of land where I could build my data center.
I mean, this is a problem that Amazon, Google, and all the big cloud providers have been trying to solve for a long time. Try to place the data centers as close to the source of electricity, among other things. You know, they think about like political stability and cost of land, and things like that too.
Yeah, so I don't know, like somewhere like Nevada or whatever. Montana?
Maybe.
Sure. I don't actually know where like the really cheap energy would be, but...
Yeah, it's all over.
Yeah, the different places where you have the cheap energy. So anyways, so we get like a handful of the top research scientists. We get a big hunk of land, ideally next to a power plant. Maybe we could like do some sort of like agreement with the local government there to like get us like really good
subsidies.
Cheap... Which one?
Subsidies.
Yeah, subsidies. Yeah, because of all the jobs that we'd bring.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you have to build the plant and like, you know, put the GPUs in there and stuff like that.
That feels like a outright lie though. All the jobs we're gonna bring with this AI thing.
Well, I mean like
but maybe that's a topic for another day.
Okay. Yeah. So anyways, we could discuss that one later. But anyways, you can make the argument. So yeah. All right. I think we are just about out of time, yeah. So I feel like we should probably wrap this up, but
yeah, this is a good one.
Anyways, thanks for listening, guys.
Until next time.